Hi, everybody, and thanks for tuning in to the UBS Global Research Pod Hub, a channel that shares insights from economists, strategists, and equity analysts on the pivotal questions and events shaping today's markets. My name is Tim Ramskill, Global Head of Product Management at UBS Research, and I'm joined today by Professor Paul Marsh, Emeritus Professor of Finance at the London Business School. Paul, along with his colleagues Elroy Dimpson and Mike Staunton, are the authors of the Global Investment Returns Yearbook, which is published in partnership with UBS. Paul, welcome to today's podcast. Paul, perhaps to kick things off, I thought it'd be great just to sort of set the scene. You've been doing this now for 25 years, so maybe if I could take you back to the sort of the start of your process here, what was the original sort of genesis of the work back in early 2000?
Back in 2000, we knew quite a lot about American investment returns over the long run, but we knew almost nothing about the rest of the world. So we wanted to fill that gap and look at other countries and see how a global investor would have done historically. And we started off in 2000 with just a dozen countries, but now we've got 35 countries. We cover stocks, bonds, bills, inflation, currencies, and we also have five composite indices, the world ex-US, Europe, developed markets and emerging markets.
And I guess, Paul, there's an enormous wealth of content within the yearbook, and we're going to touch on some of that today. But what do you see as sort of the headline grabbers, the consistent features that have always driven the narrative when you're talking to the work?
Equities have done best historically. Equities have beaten inflation in every country we've looked at. Equities have beaten bonds. Equities have beaten cash. And so the big story is that equities for the long run, and also that you have obtained historically a handsome premium for taking the risk of equities. The law of risk and return, we sometimes call it. Equities are the riskiest asset class. They've done the best. Cash is the least risky. That's done the worst.
And again, you touched on this a little bit at the start in terms of the content within the yearbook has expanded over time. I know as well that the number of topics covered and the range of things you've sought to add to the body of work has also evolved. Maybe just again a little bit of the context there as to what's driven that and how the work has evolved.
I guess it's been driven by partly by what's topical in a particular year, although because you have to write the yearbook, and you have to decide on your topic a long time before you know what's going to be topical in February of the year when you publish it. It's always a hard call. But sometimes we've been going by topicality. Sometimes it's just topics that we haven't covered before. So last year we covered corporate bonds, a big asset class, but it's something we've had very little to say on historically, and so we filled that gap. We did the same with commodity futures, although commodities was inspired by the fact that inflation was racing away, and so did commodities provide an opportunity to hedge against inflation? It's that kind of thinking that's driven the year-by-year topics. This year, we're looking at concentration, because that's a big topic, and we're coupling that with diversification, because that's the opposite of concentration.
Perfect. Well, maybe come back to that topic in just a moment. So if we do sort of fast forward to the 2025 edition of the yearbook, the topic of American exceptionalism probably features more meaningfully today than perhaps at any stage. But again, I think there's some interesting comparisons, and you can make some interesting comparisons between your thoughts on this particular theme, again, from 25 years ago, as well as today. So how do you think about that?
Back in 2000, we found that the US was the world's best performing equity market. And it was 49%, approaching 50% of the world global capitalization. And at that time, we thought that US exceptionalism would be priced into stocks, that they would perform kind of normally after that. And it's been surprising that in the 25 years that's elapsed since, that American stocks have still been the best performers. Lots of reasons for that, but that's using hindsight. But using foresight, we were surprised. And US exceptionalism is twofold, really. One is about the performance of US stocks, and the other is about the share of the world market is moved from 49% to 64% now. So if you buy a world tracker fund, you're almost two-thirds in the US, and that's that needs to be just thought about as you press the button on the ETF purchase.
And I guess, Paul, sort of sticking with that theme of exceptionalism, it then, as you mentioned, we've tackled this year within the special focus chapter, diversification and concentration. So perhaps again, sort of just pull out for us some of the highlights of that special chapter, perhaps starting with, you know, the concentration of the US market, which again, I know has been a sort of a big area of focus within the market narrative in recent times.
Yeah, I mean, the US has got a lot more concentrated in recent years, largely because of the huge technology stocks at the top of the US market. And US is now at its most concentrated for 92 years. If you go back to 1900, it was a bit more concentrated then, and there were periods in the 30s when it was a bit more concentrated, but not a lot. So it's almost at a 125-year high, but not quite. 37% of the US market is made up of the 10 largest stocks now. So that is really seems very concentrated. It seems concentrated till you compare it with other markets. Then you find that the US is actually reasonably well diversified. If you look at the Swiss market, for example, the 10 largest stocks are 70% of the Swiss market. So relatively, the US is still quite a diversified market, but the concentration has been increasing very sharply. What's been even more tricky has been performance concentration. And that's the fact that the larger stocks have been making up a very large proportion of the returns of the S&P 500 or the US market as a whole. For example, at the start of 2024, the larger stocks made up 34% of the S&P, but they accounted for 63% of its performance. So there's 490 S&P stocks that accounted for just about a third of the S&P's performance. So that makes it really hard, especially if you're an active manager trying to select stocks.
And I know you've also looked very closely at the geographical considerations around diversification. There's perhaps an interesting dynamic for US domestic focused investors to lead us into this part of the conversation. But again, how would you summarize the work, and what can we learn from those considerations and that portion of the history?
Most countries, most markets, their investors have benefited from investing globally. They've achieved a better reward to risk ratio from doing that. The US is a startling exception. And the reason for that is that US domestic returns have been very high. And the US has also been a fairly low risk market because it is relatively well diversified compared with other markets. And so when you look at the US, the benefits of international diversification, certainly over the last 40 years or so, have been negative. It's been American investors would have been better off staying at home with hindsight. With foresight, we would still encourage even American investors to invest globally. And that's because the diversification benefits are potentially large. But you can have sensible decisions that go wrong. And for Americans over the last 40 years, they've done so well at home that global diversification would have been the wrong choice. But that's with hindsight.
And again, another consistent feature of the yearbook is considerations around inflation and also interest rate cycles. And I guess if we think back to when you and I were working together on the project a year ago, there probably was an expectation at that point in time that pretty much all central banks were set to cut rates. Fast forward to today, and I guess the sort of the reality has been, and the most recent trend has been, one of a slight divergence in monetary policy, particularly between the ECB and the Fed. So again, perhaps a topical opportunity to revisit again what history tells us from your analysis around the interplay between inflation, rates, and also then stock performance.
History suggests that inflation once it gets a little bit out of control, can be quite sticky. And we've seen some of that. Although inflation has come down very rapidly from its recent spike, there are still worries about inflation. There are still worries that policies in the US in particular might rekindle inflation. Inflation is not good for stocks. People regularly say that stocks are a hedge against inflation. If stocks were a hedge against inflation, when inflation goes up, you'd find that stocks went up. But in fact, you find the opposite. Inflation is bad for stock prices, just as it's bad for bond prices. But it's more obvious in the case of bonds. So inflation is not a good thing. Inflation also, when it gets out of control, invokes a policy response. And we then find central banks enter into hiking cycles. And the evidence historically is that stocks have done far less well, as have bonds, when there is a hiking cycle. And that the really good periods for stocks have been when interest rates have been coming down or are stable. So inflation and hiking cycles are not good for stocks. And at the moment, there is a continued debate about what's going to happen in the US and how quickly rates will fall. And the jury is out on quite a lot of that.
And I guess, Paul, as you yourself describe, it's become something of a tradition when we get to the yearbook to think about what the future might hold. I know you sort of tend to shy away from big predictions and really want to lean on the history, but nonetheless, you do provide a sort of very long-term perspective on what investors could expect from this stage going forwards in terms of different asset class returns. So maybe you can expand on that and sort of share with us your current thoughts.
Yes, I mean, we've looked at the returns that global investors would have obtained by generation, if you like. So we go back to the baby boomers and we see the returns that they have earned through till the present. And we look through till millennials. And equity returns have been extraordinarily good if you were a baby boomer and you got into the market early. Bond returns have also been very good over the last 40 years or so. Prospectively, we are looking at somewhat lower bond returns than we've achieved because bond returns were just too good to be true in the 40 years that we call the golden age of bonds. And equity returns were also too good to be true in the second half of the 20th century. They were just astronomical. And so prospectively, returns are lower than the baby boomers achieved. Bond returns are lower than any of recent generations have achieved. And we have some very simple projections based on the current real rate of interest, plus some measures of the equity risk premium and the bond risk premium. And based on those, we're projecting currently for the next generation, next 30 or 40 years, say, perfectly good returns, equity returns around about 4.5%, bond returns around about 2.5% in real terms, that's after inflation. But those are a little bit lower than in the past. They are still good returns, but they don't include all of the windfall gains that some of the previous generations enjoyed.
Paul, that's excellent. Thank you very much for your time and for joining me today. So thanks to the listeners for visiting the UBS Research Pod Hub. That was an overview of the 2025 edition of the Global Investment Returns Yearbook with me, Tim Ramskill, Global Head of Product Management here at UBS Research, and with my guest today, Professor Paul Marsh. If you've enjoyed the episode, please tune in again and feel free to share this with your friends and colleagues. Thank you.
This content has been prepared by UBS AG, its subsidiaries and or affiliates, and is purely informational in nature. It is not investment research and does not contain an investment recommendation nor investment or professional advice. It is not an offer or solicitation to engage in any investment activity, and you should seek your own financial, tax, and legal advice before engaging in any such activity. UBS has no responsibility to you in relation to this content. It has no regard to your personal circumstances or investment objectives, and receiving it does not imply any form of client relationship with UBS for any legal, regulatory, or tax purpose. This content is not intended for distribution into any jurisdiction where to do so would be contrary to law or regulation. UBS does not accept any liability over the content of such material or reliance upon any information contained herein. The views and opinions expressed by any guest speaker or third party are not those of UBS. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over any such views and opinions expressed by such persons. This content is the valuable intellectual property of UBS, and UBS specifically prohibits the redistribution of it in whole or in part without its prior written permission. UBS 2025, the key symbol and UBS are among the registered and unregistered trademarks of UBS. All rights reserved.